I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact, among others. The Children's Television Workshop, now called the Sesame Workshop, started the Joan Ganz Cooney Center in 2007 to study the effects of digital technology on childhood literacy. Joan was inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1990, and she's received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you remember your first introduction to the alphabet or numbers?
Well, I do, as a matter of fact. I did not go to kindergarten, but I started first grade before I was six. And I don't think I'd been taught the alphabet, because I remember it being on cards around the room, and I got it right away. I was so ready for school, having not gone to kindergarten, that I started reading pretty quickly and knowing the alphabet.
How come you didn't go to kindergarten?
My mother didn't want me to leave home. I was the last of her three children, and so she had made me stay at home. So here I was, raring to go by the time I got to first grade at five.
Do you remember, was there a book popular or part of the cultural zeitgeist that you can recall when you were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old? Like, what was your Sesame Street?
I don't remember the children's books that I was read, because... For one thing, the books that were being read were probably aimed slightly higher than my age, because my three of us were born in 3 years and 3 months, and I was the youngest. So I think probably most of the story books were aimed a little higher. I don't remember the books I was read until I started reading, when it was the Bobbsey Twins and the Little Colonel and those children's series. But I started reading chapter books right away. I did not spend much time on picture books, but I remember Dick and Jane, which was the first reading book in first grade. I remember it very well.
What did your parents do?
My mother was a stay-at-home mom, and my father was a banker. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up in a very traditional kind of home.
This was in the 1930s.
1930s and 40s.
In Arizona. Do you remember your first interaction with television, your early interactions with television?
There was the Adlai Stevenson-Dwight Eisenhower campaign of 1951, maybe, or 52. And I watched Adlai Stevenson's acceptance speech at the convention. That was the first thing I remember. And then it was two or three years later that the Army-McCarthy hearings came on and changed history, and I watched some of that. I didn't have a TV set, so I was dependent on the kindness of neighbors to see television.
You were in New York City in your 20s. What made you come to New York?
I had known, I don't know, from the time I was the littlest child, that I would not live in Phoenix. And I went to the University of Arizona for college, and all during that period, my best friends were people that wanted to leave Phoenix and do something. And one of them, I went to Washington, so I joined her and her family in Washington after I graduated and worked for the federal government in the State Department. And then I went back to Phoenix and worked on a newspaper until I saved enough money to move to New York. But that was almost always the goal.
What did you do when you came to New York?
I tried to get a job at the New York Times and was eventually offered one on the women's page, naturally, and that was easy for me to turn down. What I had in mind was being an intrepid reporter on stories. And I had been on the women's page of the Arizona Republic, but they had given me lots of broader assignments than writing about weddings and tea parties and that sort of thing. And I knew the women's page at the Times would be restricted to weddings, and that was not for me. And I went into the press and public information department of RCA, which owned NBC. And as soon as I could, I transferred down to NBC and did publicized their soap operas and other kinds of programs that they had, other programs that they had.
And what was your personal life like at the time?
I lived with a girl I had grown up with in Phoenix, and she was an actress and in Hollywood most of the time. So I had her apartment, and she knew everybody in New York for a variety of reasons. Her family was in Phoenix very prominent, so they met every Easterner that came out, every famous Easterner. So she knew, she had a very wide circle of prominent friends, and she very generously shared all these people with me. So I was in a life that wasn't, that was very starry, and that part was fun, but I was, felt not up. I mean, here I was with no achievement at all, and I was with people who were directors of television plays and director of Broadway plays and heads of production companies and all of that. And here was little me, was how I felt. But eventually I left RCA and went to NBC and then left NBC because I couldn't make enough money to live, mm-hmm. practically, and went to work for the U.S. Steel Corporation to publicize their play that was on every 2 weeks on television called The U.S. Steel Hour.
What was that about, The U.S. Steel Hour?
It was a drama every 2 weeks. It alternated with someone else's, another corporation's drama. But ours was produced by the Theater Guild, which was a very prominent production, Broadway production company in New York. And so I learned a lot about theater, about casting. It was in the bad old days when we had there was a list of people you couldn't cast in, or whose names, whose plays you could not accept, because they were said to have red ties.
Communist ties.
Yeah. So it was an interesting period that you had to clear, that we had to clear all names with the advertising agency.
How did you develop an interest in entertainment and in journalism? Your dad was a banker. Your mom was a housewife from Arizona. How did you fall into that world?
Well, I took acting and acted in the plays, school plays, and little theater when I was in high school. So I always had an interest in being an actress. But my father said, if you are an actress, you will never receive a penny of support from me. Thank God he said that, because I had the interest, but I was much better behind the scenes, behind the camera, as it were. And I majored in education and came out certified to teach in Arizona, which I had no intention of doing. But in those days, mothers said to their daughters, in case your husband dies, you'll have a job that will give you the same hours as your children and the vacation time when your children have vacation time. So all the little girls of my generation, or many, majored in education. But I never was going to spend my life with children and women. I mean, at that time, I wanted to be where the action was, and that's where journalism and television and so on.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. The Sesame Workshop created Sesame Street in 1969. The germ of Children's Television Workshop started at a dinner party that you had at your home with your husband, then Tim Cooney.
That's correct.
At the time. How did that happen?
Tim and I were friends of Lloyd Morissette and Mary Morissette. Lloyd was vice president of Carnegie Corporation, the big foundation. And we were very close to my boss at Channel 13, who was a very theatrical, dramatic, and brilliant man. So he was there at the dinner party, plus someone I worked with named Anne Bement. So it was six of us. And Lewis, this very dramatic boss of mine, started talking in a very stunning, interesting, compelling way about the educational potential of television. His talk sparked something in Lloyd. Carnegie Corporation was financing studies of how children learn, child development, and so something clicked in his mind of why not use television to teach preschoolers? Because preschoolers were marching to the center of the stage at that time. The government was talking about creating something that became Head Start. Early childhood had become more interesting to educators than it had ever been before. And so he asked me if I'd be willing to take a leave of 3 months from being a producer at 13. I was producing adult shows, talk shows and documentaries, but I was I was frustrated because you can do one documentary after another and have no effect on the society. And I wanted to see if television could make a real difference. That had been haunting me. So it was a perfect moment for me when Lloyd said, "Would you like to do this?" And the answer is yes, I would, even though my boss didn't want me to. He wanted me to stay at 13. I took a leave from programming for 3 months and went all over the country talking to educators of preschool children.
You wrote a paper as a result called "The Potential Uses of Television in Preschool Education." And what were the major findings of the paper?
I met with several gifted teachers of gifted children, teachers of preschool children who were in pilot programs that the government was doing as a precursor to Head Start. And if they had said no, this would be terrible. We couldn't have done it. But they were very supportive of the idea. It was all yes, why not? It was so I did a report on their reactions, and then I did described something like Sesame Street, an hour a day, a show that would be something like Sesame Street run by a corporation, a nonprofit corporation, something like the Children's Television Workshop, which is now called Sesame Workshop. And so you could see it on paper, and it was very well received, the paper, by Carnegie and Ford and the government.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact. We'll hear more from Joan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, which created shows like Sesame Street, The Electric Company, and 321 Contact, among others. The Children's Television Workshop, now called the Sesame Workshop, started the Joan Ganz Cooney Center in 2007 to study the effects of digital technology on childhood literacy. Joan was inducted into the Television Hall of Fame in 1990, and she's received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So as a result of this paper, you suggested the launch of the Children's Television Workshop, and you suggested that they start a show which was at the time not called Sesame Street. How did you come up with the name Sesame Street?
Well, we were panic-stricken toward the end. We did not have a name. We had decided to put it on a street. We knew it was going to be on an inner-city street. We even knew what street. It was a copy of a street in East Harlem. And
which street was it? Do you know?
I can't remember, but it is something like East 116th Street. I've seen it. It was a street that, by the way, had a mural on one of the buildings, and we had that mural on Sesame Street. So once we knew we were on a street, we had to then find a title. There was even someone wanted to call it 123 Avenue B, and I said, that's too hip and too urban. So finally we got a list of about 60 titles, and we all decided that Sesame Street was the least bad. I don't know why we hated it, because we were hip. It was the late 60s, and so that's why Sesame Street seemed oh so sweet, and we did. Nobody wanted sweet, and then we all wanted sweet. I decided sweet was better. And so that was how we got Sesame Street. Partially, the head of our public information was saying, you guys are going to go on the air without any audience.
How did you come up with the idea of having the show be in a city with an urban feel?
Well, we had three extraordinarily gifted producers, John Stone, Sam Gibbon, and Dave Connell, all of whom had worked on Captain Kangaroo previously. John Stone was something of a genius, and everybody knew it at the time. And he's the one that came up with the urban street idea. And we all said, yeah, because our mandate was to reach inner city disadvantaged kids primarily. That is, if we didn't reach them and reached everybody else, it would have been considered a failure.
At what point after it started airing did you say, wow, we have something much bigger here in our hands than we ever expected?
Right away, actually, as soon as it went on the air, the reaction was like swoosh. The press was overwhelmingly favorable, and the audience reaction was overwhelmingly favorable. There were some academic critics, but there were very few of those, and I remember every interview I did with the press, they'd say, how do you feel about your critics? I wanted to say, that is so the least of what we're dealing with here. To me, it was so actually trivial compared to what was really happening out there that it was like, for me, batting away flies. That's not nice to say, but that's how it felt. It was an amazing moment because the women's movement was coming on stream. So the press was not only deeply impressed with Sesame Street, but deeply impressed with the fact that a woman had founded it, which meant they all wanted to talk to me, which was I kept bringing along Dave Connell to interviews and felt terrible that these geniuses weren't getting the attention they should.
You launched Sesame Street in November 1969.
That's right.
And that was with the help of producers like John Stone, who had been at Captain Kangaroo
yes.
prior. How did you meet Jim Henson, and how did that collaboration begin?
Well, I had seen a reel of his work, and he was so admired within the industry, much less known outside, that it never crossed my mind that we could get him. And John Stone and Dave, and probably Sam, too, had worked with him. They said to me, I think we'll talk to Jim Henson, the producer said. And I said, Jim Henson? I mean, to me, that was like saying Peter the Apostle. It was amazing. And I said, do you think he would do it? And they said, who knows? But they went and talked to him, and he said he didn't want to do little children shows, that he would then be categorized as a little children's producer, and that terrified him because he considered himself a family program producer, like The Muppet Show was his ideal show. However, he went home and thought, I have four children. He eventually had five, and it would be something to do for them and their peers. So I knew when we captured Jim Henson, I knew we had it, that we couldn't fail. And then Joe Raposo, the great composer, musician, came to work for us.
A lot of people came to you because they were driven by civil rights.
Yes, they were interested in children, but they were the idea of expressing the interest in what was going on in America, the civil rights movement, expressing it by trying to reach these children in need was very appealing to this group. Mm. I don't mean that they weren't interested in children because they were interested in civil rights, but the two interests they had came together perfectly.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. You mentioned right from the start that the show was widely accepted. What was harder for you than you thought it would be in getting Sesame Street off the ground?
What was harder? It was so much luck. We had so much luck. The timing could not have been better for raising the money, because at that time government and private foundations were, and then Corporation for Public Broadcasting came on stream, and public television as a big entity, they were interested. So the timing was all amazing. In the beginning, we had a hard time convincing some of the representatives of the federal government that Children's Television Workshop, an entity that did not exist and had never produced children's programming, headed by a woman who had never produced a children's program. It was hard convincing them that that was the way to go rather than give the money to a cartoon company. And so we had to kind of battle our way through that. But eventually everybody got aboard, even though a woman at one of the foundations, Ford, said it will never be taken seriously if a woman heads it.
How did you get funding for the show initially? You just talked about this perfect storm of the federal government and private foundations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting all coming together.
We couldn't possibly have raised it had it not been for the brilliance of Lloyd Morissette.
Who at the time was the head of the Carnegie Foundation.
He was vice president of Carnegie, but the driver of this particular project. He knew Harold Howe at the Department of, then the Office of Education, but it would be the department now. And that we wanted half the money from the government and got it.
How much money did you raise initially?
We raised $8 million originally. We raised four from the private foundations and CPB and four from the government.
Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Yes.
Now, $8 million in 1969, that's not an insignificant amount of money.
No, it would be like a 40 or 50 today, and people were shocked that that kind of money was being raised for a children's show. When we announced it, it was front page New York Times because it was unbelievable that anyone would spend that kind of money on children. And then the social purposes of the program caught the fancy of the Times and other press.
You mentioned the terrific response that the show got by critics, but there were still some people who were skeptical because you were using television as a medium. What were they saying?
I had made the mistake of saying that maybe we could close the gap between the achievement of poor children, disadvantaged children, and middle class, and that was picked up that within a few months that we certainly weren't closing the gap. And that was absolutely accurate because the middle class was making gains too. So it moved everybody up, but it didn't close any gap. So that was a very unfortunate phrase. So that was criticized.
Now, what was going on in your home life at the time? You didn't have children, so you didn't have to focus on that. But certainly your life had experienced this sea change, going from a producer of public television, and all of a sudden this storm comes of Children's Television Workshop and Sesame Street that was much larger than you ever expected. Can you talk me through those days of working on this early on?
Well, I was working all the time. And I think it was hard on my husband. I don't question that. That marriage ended in divorce in 1975, and it had nothing to do with Sesame Street, but I'm sure it was hard on him, all the focus on me. And I remember hating that we'd walk into a room and everyone would ignore him. So I'm sorry about it, but there was nothing I could do about it. And he was interesting. He was very involved in civil rights and was very helpful to me in many ways. He was the first feminist I ever knew. I had never met a woman who was a feminist, even.
Especially the woman at the Ford Foundation.
Yeah, right. But he was a feminist, so he was always pressing me to aim at being number one. He was also a very good writer and could help me when I was doing speeches and various things. But eventually he had problems that were not really manageable.
But he was always supportive of what you were doing.
Oh, very.
You are married now to Pete Peterson.
Yes.
And he is the founder of the Blackstone Group.
Yes.
Incidentally, did Pete Peterson play a role in Sesame Street at all?
He did, oddly enough. He was on the board of NET, and NET was the old National Production Center for Public Broadcasting. And I wanted them to administer the workshop for the first year and a half because we didn't know if we wanted to hire lawyers and accountants and all that. What if we failed and had all this staff to fire? So my idea was hire those that we had to have and then ask NET to supply the lawyers, accountants, and administration. And in order to do that, Jack White, who was president, said, you've got to present that to my board, and they've got to approve. And Pete Peterson was on the board, and he asked question after question. He was just fascinated with the idea and came up and said, this is one of the most interesting ideas I've ever heard. Well, naturally, I never forgot him. But we were both married to different people. Our lives went on in separate ways. And then we finally met again when both of us were divorced. It was very romantic.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of the Children's Television Workshop, now called Sesame Workshop. The Sesame Workshop created Sesame Street. What did Sesame Street look like in 1969?
It was slower. It was accused of being too fast-paced. But when I look at the early shows, they seem very slow to me. We've changed it a lot now. Elmo was not on early shows and became the superstar when we were about the superstar when we were about 20 years into it. And he now greatly is far more popular than Big Bird. But Big Bird is iconic. I always say he is held up like a crucifix to vampires in the Congress every time they threaten to cut us.
So Sesame Street took off immediately in the United States.
Yes.
When did it start to go global?
Well, the Germans came to me within a year and asked if they could do a co-production for Germany. And their Big Bird was a bear. And Bert and Ernie are a huge sensation in Germany and have always been. And then the next thing that happened was that Latin America wanted a version, and we ended up doing that in Mexico for all of Latin America except Brazil. And then it began spreading to the Netherlands, Canada, which took the American show but makes Canadian, inserts Canadian films, and they've made it. It's called Sesame Street North. Australia, the English-speaking countries like Australia and Canada wanted it pretty quickly.
Except for England.
Just wanted the Muppet pieces, did not want Sesame Street because they did not want Americans teaching English children. Now, of course, we're in Bangladesh, we're in South Africa with an AIDS-positive Muppet, and we're working in Pakistan, and we're starting an Afghanistan version.
And how is that perceived by society in Afghanistan, which tends to be conservative? How do you make adjustments accordingly?
We work with their people and their educators, and they choose what they want to emphasize. They may not want to emphasize letters and numbers. They may want to emphasize the values of mutual respect and understanding, which is a big value in our foreign productions. There's one version in Northern Ireland which emphasizes mutual respect and understanding. We're in Israel and Palestine with different versions. We had hoped to have more unity, but it didn't work out.
And there are characters that remain the same throughout all the countries, like is Oscar the Grouch in all these?
Oscar is, and Big Bird are the same puppeteer. No, they, for example, Israel's Big Bird, or the iconic Muppet, is a porcupine. Tough on the outside, soft on the inside. One Israeli said it should be the reverse.
Your whole life has been focused on children's education through entertainment, yet you don't have any children of your own. How come?
Well, I wanted children, and that just didn't happen. I really was deeply disappointed in my first marriage that didn't happen, but it didn't. I ended up with five stepchildren and nine grandchildren. So children are very much in my life now and have been for many years. Many, many, many of the greatest artists, of writers, playwrights, book writers of children's television, of children's material, have never married and don't have children. Maurice Sendak is one that's never married and has no children.
He's Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah. So is the author of Alice in Wonderland, I believe. I don't know. It's a very, many, many men, many single men are big artists and writers of children's material. I can't be sure, but I would suggest it's because they still have the child in them for whatever reasons.
Do you feel like you have an inner child or a child within you?
Yes, I do, unfortunately. But the grown-up has conquered. And those that keep the child stay creative, and those that have, the grown-up conquers become the executives. Darn. I have this theory that we're all sort of a combination of our fathers and mothers, and that my father triumphed finally in me, because much of me was very satisfied with being an executive, of bringing order out of chaos and being the boss. I really loved being the boss. I made up an aphorism that was in Forbes magazine, which is, I've been bossed and I've been boss, and believe me, being boss is better.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Joan Ganz Cooney, co-founder of Children's Television Workshop and one of the founders of Sesame Street.
Coming up, we'll meet Stephen McDonald, founder of Applegate Farms. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Stephen McDonald, the founder of Applegate Farms. Applegate is a natural organic meat company that has been part of the natural meat movement since the early 1980s. The company's meat is sold in delis and natural food stores like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's across the United States. Stephen started Applegate when he was 32, and he used to be a vegetarian until he sold a healthy meat that even he would eat. Applegate supports over 200 family farms who are dedicated to the humane treatment of animals. Welcome. Stephen, before we go into the history of Applegate Farms, I'd like to know exactly what Applegate Farms is.
Applegate Farms is a natural foods meat company that provides about 130 different products, meat products, all cooked or processed, as we call it, bacons, hot dogs, deli meats, chicken pot pies, nuggets, items like that.
I want to understand what led you to this point, and I'm wondering what you were doing before you founded Applegate, which you founded when you were 32 years old.
Right before getting into Applegate, I was working for my brother-in-law, who is an Irish glassblower named Simon Pierce, who's got a small glassblowing business in Vermont. And I had been a management consultant in Boston, getting bored with all the kind of theoretical, wonderful ideas, but couldn't get my hands into anything. And this was 1986, at the point that his business was taking off and needed some support. So I went to work for him and just fell in love with the small business environment. At that point, I knew that I needed to do something on that level, which ultimately led me to Applegate.
You were working for Simon for how long?
I worked for him for about 2 years.
How come you didn't continue working with him?
Well, I left that because when I got in there, we started to turn things around, and I looked at this business, and I said, Simon, you're my brother-in-law. He's married to my oldest sister, Pia. And I said, Simon, you've got to cut me in on this. I'm your brother-in-law. And he thought about it, and the day I asked him, he was lying flat on his back with his back going out. And, of course, I chose that perfect moment to walk into his office. He's lying horizontal on the floor to propose this idea that he cut me in on his business, which he had started in the early 1970s. So he, in his very typical, charming Irish way, said, let me think about it, and came back a couple of weeks later and said, no, I don't think that's a good idea for you or for me. course, I was completely stunned that he wouldn't want me there. In retrospect, that's the best thing that ever happened to me because it forced me out to go get on, you know, find something on my own.
Right. And so did you say, okay, fine, if you're not going to make me part of the management, I'm leaving. Was it that sort of vitriolic?
Oh, yeah, no. And it was obvious to him when he said it that we could no longer continue because I really crossed the equity line. And when you cross the equity line, you're in with both feet or out with both feet.
What did you do from there? You're like, okay, I'm no longer working for Simon Pierce and I am now just going to go start a meat company? Or
no,
how did that happen?
As I said, before Simon, I'd done the management consulting. At that point, I was so frightened. I knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and everything that I had done had led me to that point, but it's still obviously a very scary step. So I immediately tried to retreat back into management consulting and had these interviews with these management consulting firms who in the first 5 minutes said, Steve, you do not want to go back into consulting. You need to go out and do something on your own. So I just started looking for a business and ran into a friend at a New Year's Eve party who told me about a business that he was looking at and said, well, we can do it together. So I went and looked at this company called Jugtown Mountain Smokehouse, which was the original name. And it was a small, you know, 5,000 square foot smoked meat facility. And I said, Chris, you know, this thing is too small. Either you do it or I'll do it. So he called back a couple of weeks later and said, I'm not going to do it if you're not going to do it. And so I kind of jumped in.
You mentioned that you were entrepreneurial, like you just felt that you had it in your blood. How did you know?
Well, having struggled through school and been in a lot of academic environments where I wasn't motivated or excited, I always knew. I was the kid that, you know, in high school they said, well, you just got to wait till the guy gets to college before he does something. And then I go to college and they said, well, you're just going to have to wait till after college. So it was in the small business environment that I felt like my brain woke up. What I say to people is my IQ goes up and down in direct proportion to how close my butt is next to a fire. So if I'm at high risk, I get very smart. As soon as I start working for somebody else and it's not mine, I just don't have the same mental acumen or focus or interest to solve problems, to try things, and my creativity just kind of goes down if it's not mine.
Did you have any influence from your mother or father in the business world at all? What did they do?
My mother was taking care of 9 kids, and my father was an investment banker, you know, in New York. Neither of them had direct entrepreneurial experience. I think my father taught me how to reach out and connect with people, networking. My mother was more of the one who taught me that I could do it. And she, if she was, you know, 30 years old now moving into a career, there isn't a company in America that she couldn't run well. And even though she wasn't in the business environment, she taught all those principles of focus and will and desire about, you know, getting whatever it is you want to do.
So moving from your family life to this natural meat company, how did it then go from Jugtown to Applegate Farms?
Well, we were doing nitrate-free product and product that was not using phosphates or, you know, adding water to the product. So we were in a very high-quality product, but we hadn't migrated yet to antibiotic-free or organic meat. So the business started to grow, and we had these old gravity pit smokehouses, which are just the old-style smokehouses, which had been there for years. And we got those smokehouses going so fast and running so often that we basically lit 2,000 pounds of bacon on fire one night when it was smoking overnight, and the whole back end of the business burnt down. So those are one of those seminal moments when you think the world is coming to an end after you've worked so hard. In 3 weeks, we had that back up and running, and this is with USDA inspections and controls. But in the interim, we had to tell our customers to go to our competitors to get product. And we had to go to our competitors to have the stuff we needed made in the interim. So all of a sudden, we started getting these shipments in from our competitors or different people. And we're like, wow, this stuff's better than what we do. And at that moment, I kind of realized there was tons of production facilities doing smoked meats and other type of meat. What there really wasn't was a brand out there that was dedicated to focusing on producing healthy organic or natural meat that was focused on the consumer.
So it was all by accident, in a way, that you discovered that you wanted to be in the natural organic meat business as a result of your smokehouse burning down and getting the meats from your competitors? Everything
we've done, we've learned by mistake or as an accident. The percentage that we knew what we were going to do when we grew up and actually executed to that level, the day-to-day is all 90% stumbling.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Stephen McDonald, the founder of Applegate Farms, a natural organic meat company that sells products to Whole Foods and other natural food stores around the United States. Walk me through the life of a cow in your company. Let's say you're a cow in Uruguay. How does it end up on my dinner plate in New York?
When you say no antibiotics, you're basically saying they'll never be sick, which means you have to completely change the way that you treat them. The difference between organic meat and antibiotic meat is they're raised exactly the same way. One is fed organic grain, certified organic grain, and the other one is not. But in all cases, you never use antibiotics, and you're never using animal byproducts. So the analogy I use is if you've got children, if your kids are going to go to a daycare center, and you are going to say you will never give those kids any antibiotics if they get sick, there are a couple of things you're going to do differently. You're going to make sure you feed the kid very well because you don't have the backup of giving an antibiotic. So nutritionally, you're going to focus, and in this case, it means not using animal byproducts, which are cheap meats, but very good grains. You're also going to house them differently. So you want them to have access to fresh air. You want them to have sunlight. You want them to exercise. They need room to exercise. And so the physical environment is much more attuned to supporting the immune system and building the immune system of each of the animals. And then the third piece of it is sanitation and control. So what needs to happen, these barns need to rest. So every once in a while, you have no birds or animals if they're in houses, and let the natural process of germs disinfect itself and then restore it. If you try to cram the animals up too tightly and accelerate their growth with hormones or steroids, feed them lousy feed, you're going to get systemic diseases. On the humane issue, what we feel is that these animals ultimately are dedicating themselves to becoming food for humans. And our responsibility is to honor that process, respect those animals, and give them disease-free environments that are healthy and ones in which their immune systems can support their growth.
So they go from this life of luxury to the slaughterhouse in, let's say, Uruguay. And then, Right. Then what happens?
Then what happens is we will take whatever we're making, if we're making roast beef or we're making beef hot dogs or whatever, we'll send the appropriate meat to the different processors who then receive our raw material, and then they have strict quality control standards. They can only run this product first because you can't be running commercial product and then our stuff without doing a whole sanitation process in the interim. So we're usually brought in, and we can take the date code of a product that you buy in the store, and we can trace it back to the lot that it was made at the processor. We can also trace it back to the lot when that animal was slaughtered, and we can also trace it back then to the farms. So traceability is a very important issue for our consumers and for us to know what we're actually receiving at the end of the day.
So take me back to the very beginning. Before your smokehouse burnt down, how did you fund it initially? Did you have outside capital or was it all your own?
I closed in July of 1987, which was right before the October crash, stock market crash. I went to a bank who ended up loaning me 120% of the purchase price. So I had $35,000 left over in my bank account, which I was able to use to start buying inventory and paying payroll. And so as it turned out, I never put a dollar of my own or anybody else's into the business.
And why were they willing to lend you money?
I had a local banker, this old street guy named Bill Purcell, who, you know, basically loaned money to gas stations and small grocery stores. I went back to him and, you know, several years later, I go, why did you do that? Because, you know, of course, after the 90s and the whole, you know, banking issues, everything now is loaned on ratios and a banker has no leeway to kind of, you know, give the money that they want just because they like you. He turned to me and he said, he just said, I know you're going to be successful. And he went out on a flyer and that's what got me started. And when I go meet now these big bankers who want to help me grow my business, I always try to remind him of that guy who, you know, never made it into the big banking world, but was, for an entrepreneur, exactly what you need to get started.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Stephen McDonnell, the founder of Applegate Farms, a natural organic meat company that sells products to Whole Foods and other natural food stores around the United States. We've been talking about the early days of the business, and I'd like to know how you went about selling the product to customers initially.
The story that I remember most in the early days was my uncle, who was an investment banker in New York, had sold A&P to a German company. And so I was like, great. Well, you know, I called him up and said, can you get me a meeting with this, you know, with A&P? They're a huge chain, you know, here in the East. And he said, sure. So he called up the president, who then got me a meeting with the meat buyer. So I go traipsing into the meat buyer and sit down and say, hi, I'm Steve McDonnell. You know, my uncle, blah, blah, blah. And I, like an idiot, told him, you know, where, how I had gotten to him. And he turned to me before the meeting had started and he stopped me and he goes, listen, son, if you think that I am ever, or this chain will ever buy a single pound of your product because you came from the president of the company, you are sorely mistaken. Now, I have one piece of advice for you. Pick up your stuff and get out and don't ever come back. And it's true now as it was then. In the meat business, you work yourself up the ladder. You go in the ground floor and you earn your stripes. And that was a great lesson, although it was kind of shocking at the time.
You've been humbled by this A&P experience. So do you now just call the founder of Whole Foods, or do you get in through the butcher, through the meat department?
We were just starting out. They were just starting out. We were kind of like minds and just became kind of friends. And they started requesting meat that was raised without any antibiotics at all. So then we started to go out and find farmers and set up growing systems that raise those animals without antibiotics.
I want to turn to your initial partner, Chris Ely, whose father had owned the smokehouse that you acquired. And I was wondering if there are any partner issues between you and Chris.
The reason this company happened in large part was because of how easy that relationship has been. He allowed me from day one to be in control and totally saw that I was a vehicle for him because he didn't have the background I had to help this company realize its dream. So doesn't mean we don't go at it on several occasions. There was never a point where we came to, had discussions saying we're not going to work together. It's just been a wonderful, easy relationship, and I know how rare that is to find.
And it's partly easier because he relinquished control to you and he didn't have an ego about that, because you do like to be in control.
No, that's true. And he saw that and very wisely stayed away from it. He, like me, is married to a very strong woman. So both of us, you know our boundaries in certain areas, and we figured that out pretty early on.
So you're
on.
Humbled at home, but at the workplace, you like to stretch your arms a little more.
I'm way humbled at home, and I'm often humbled in the workplace, but I can kind of push back a little bit more in the workplace.
And so your wife, what's her name?
Jill Carney.
She was there throughout the growing years of the business.
She was there and never was. Her gift to me, her father's a sculptor. So what she brought to me was an understanding of small business and a love of small business. And she was in the movie business, so she was in a very stylish, fancy business with lots of attention and distractions. And here she was, and she was living in Los Angeles at the time. She would fly back east to hook up with this guy who had this small smoked meat company in New Jersey, and none of her friends in Los Angeles could understand what that was about. What that was about for her was getting back to her father being a sculptor and being working with his hands and working in a real environment. So that support, knowing that I was okay, because when I bought the business, I was so nervous about doing it and so unsure about what I was doing. I didn't tell any of my friends. I just did it. And that validation was very important. She now is getting much more involved in the company and helps out on the text on the back of the boxes are all her words. And she is a writer, and she has a way of writing our message that I think keys into our consumers far better than anybody else I've seen.
We're getting to the current stage of the company, and I want to ask you how your role has changed from the very, very early days of getting this off the ground to now a manager of how many people?
We've got about 65.
So how are you as a manager in addition to being an entrepreneur?
Well, I'm great, but you'd have to ask the employees to get the honest opinion.
Well, what would they say?
I've had a lot of employees work for me for a long period of time, and I've only lost one employee, someone who was in customer service, who I didn't really want to lose. I feel that ultimately I need to hire a number two. So
and
right
you're not
in the
threatened by that at all?
I'm totally threatened by that. I think I have way too much of my identity wrapped up in this company, which is what I've been doing nonstop. I think as the company gets bigger, to have the owner and founder that wrapped up in the business is not healthy.
And do you have advisors telling you that, or are you internally recognizing that yourself?
I don't have a board of directors, and everybody's telling me I need to, and I will eventually do that. You know, this is more from an internal reflection than it is other people. The business is going very quickly through its teenage phase. And so if you have been a entrepreneur for 18 years like I have, it's like raising your children up into the teenage years and realizing that you can't be a shrink to your own teenage child, that at some point somebody else needs to step in and do that. And there's a function there. Doesn't mean you're going to stop being the parent. You're always going to be the parent. But the child needs more than just the mom or the dad around. And so it's kind of coming into that realization.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Stephen McDonald, the founder of Applegate Farms. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.